Welcome to the Repurpose Your Career podcast, brought to you by Career Pivot. This podcast is where those of us in the second half of life come together to discuss how to repurpose our careers for the 21st century. Come listen to career experts give you proven strategies. Listen to people like you tell their stories on how they repurpose their careers. And finally, get your questions answered. Your host, Mark Miller, has made six career pivots over the last 30 years. He understands this is not about jumping out of the frying pan into a fire, but rather to create a plan where you make clear, actionable steps or pivots to a better future career. Are you ready to repurpose your career?
Welcome to episode 42 of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. My name is Mark Miller, and I'll be your host every Monday for a discussion on what it's like to repurpose your career. For any first-time listeners, let me give you a quick overview format of this podcast. This podcast is a series. First in the series is an interview with an expert. In episode 39, I interviewed Steve Preston, author of Portfolio Careers, How to Work for Passion, Pleasure, and Profit. Second in the series is an interview with someone who has repurposed their career. In episode 40, I discussed my transition into teaching high school math in an inner city high school and why I left. There were some very important lessons to be learned. The third in the series is a topic I choose. Last week's episode, I read the chapter, What is Your Personal Operating System, from my latest book, Repurpose Your Career. The fourth in the series is usually a mailbag episode, but this month I have something special planned. I will get to that in a second. That should give you a good idea of the sequence of episodes, and I encourage you to go back through the archives to find episodes that might inspire you to repurpose your career. Repurpose Your Career, a practical guide for the second half of life, is now available on Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle ebook formats. I have started recording the audio version of this book with a planned release for September of 2017. As we hit the end of August, well, things just got complicated. I am busy working on the Career Pivot membership community, which I want to launch my first beta in September. I am a sponsor for a conference called Product Camp Austin, which is keeping me busy. And lastly, it is highly probable that when you are listening to this podcast, I am in Anaheim, California for the Podcast Movement Conference. Just a lot of stuff going on for the end of August. Therefore, this week's episode is from the Brand New You show, where Ryan Roten interviewed me. Rather interesting, I will be interviewing Ryan next week about his first book, Career Cred. I hope you enjoy the interview. One of the things that happens to most of us is we play a role at work. You're supposed to behave in a certain way in different jobs. And what happens is we start taking on that role persona. And over time, we may very well decide we are that persona. And by the way, it may not be all that healthy for me.
Let's go! Hello and welcome to the Brand New You Show, the podcast dedicated to helping you build your brand and boost the credibility in your career. I'm your host, Ryan Roten, and today's guest is Mark Miller, founder of CareerPivot.com. His blog has been included in the Forbes list of top 100 career websites, and he is the author of three career-related books, including the one that we'll discuss today, Repurpose Your Career, A Practical Guide for the Second Half of Life. Mark, it is my pleasure to welcome you back to the Brand New You Show.
Well, thank you, Ryan. It's always great to be on your show.
Well, I appreciate that. And since you have been on the show once before, we're going to dispense with the usual vacation question, and we're going to dive...
Ah, darn!
Unless you've changed your mind. Have you changed your mind?
Well, I did change my mind. I was thinking about, I can't say Hawaii anymore.
Right.
Because we go to Galveston 3-4 times a year.
Okay.
And the reason why we go there all the time, because it's really funky there. We don't go for the beach. We go for the people.
I don't know if there's any theme music that goes with Galveston, Texas. I'm gonna have to try to find something. You're stretching my creativity now. So I want to go ahead and dive into your book, Repurpose Your Career, Practical Guide for the Second Half of Life. But I want to start actually the first question at the end of the book, because you make a statement that when I read it, it really kind of stood out and it hit me. And it's really something that you talk about quite a bit throughout your book too. And that statement was, most people don't really know what makes them happy at their core and what fulfills them. They pursue money, status, a skill set, and all of which provide some level of satisfaction, but not contentment. Why is contentment important in your career?
Well, it's something that we never, ever thought about. I mean, I was born in the mid-1950s. My father served in World War II. When we graduated from high school and went off to college, we were supposed to go get a job and go to work. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't supposed to be fun.
Right.
And the idea was after 30 or 40 years, you would retire and then you could have fun. And the reality is they moved my cheese.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to live a lot longer than my father did. And the reality is I now have to go look and say, okay, I've got 30 years ahead of me of working. And by the way, I'm in my 60s. Yes, I have no plans on retiring. Is going, okay, I can do something I actually enjoy. So what the hell is that? And that's a foreign concept for most of us. Because I said, work wasn't supposed to be
right.
Fun.
No, it's not. And I can totally relate to this because you talk specifically a couple sections in your book about Gen Xers, and that the subtitle of that chapter is actually successful career equals good life. And so we were brought up with that mentality of go to school, get good grades, get a good job, you'll live happily ever after. And you know, that's just not the case. At some point now we're seeing actually millennials and the younger generation taking jobs that are more aligned with what you just talked about, as opposed to taking a job, say, necessarily because that's what you were expected to do as you got out of school. And I'm wondering how do you see millennials and how they're impacting the workforce, impacting the other generations as well?
Well, it's interesting. I claim the millennials are the echo of us boomers. That's why we call them echo boomers. They are doing all the things we wish we had. Mm. Now, one of the things we told our kids, I said, boomers, we're supposed to go to work. We'll be happy when we retire. Gen Xers, you go to work when you're successful in your career, you'll be happy. Well, that didn't work. So what did we tell our kids? Follow your passion. The money will follow. Well, that didn't work either. The millennials or Gen Y is much more in tune with what's important to them. The money is less important. Just like we were just talking here about mass transit. They don't want a car. Freedom to them is an iPhone. And so they grew up with a different value system. And in my opinion, they're going to change work for the better.
I can personally see that happening in my work life in that, you know, I can now work from home, which never would have been ever considered at the first part of my career. But now as I'm, you know, moving into, we'll say the middle-ish portion of my career, I see the impact that the millennials are having because they want, you know, they value that work-life balance and they know with the technology that exists, they don't have to sit in an office all day long to do the same job, even better than what they could have done had they been sitting there all the time. And so I benefit from that as well. And I'm wondering too, just as we're looking at that particular benefit, because one of the things that has enabled that is technology. How have you seen technology not only influence the workforce today, but how is it going to influence the workforce as, you know, as people move along in their careers and they get to that point where they're looking at the second half of their life?
Well, I just did a blog post on this on creative destruction. We are seeing more and more changes in the workforce. We are seeing entire industries wiped out. Look at your iPhone, right? Now, that's a simple one, but, you know, I can completely manage all of my finances on my phone. I can find my keys through my Tile app. There's all kinds of things that the phone has dramatically changed things. So one of the things you have to look at is how is automation going to affect your career, particularly as information gets completely digitized. In fact, you did a podcast about the reputation economy. And in that book, the author talks about the fact that data, it's more expensive to delete data than it is to add more storage. So we're seeing medical records digitized, which means radiologists, MRIs, all that can be read by a bot. By the way, the Washington Post does all of their sports and election reporting done by bots. Journalism, in some ways, is being taken over by robotics and automation. So if you think your job is immune from automation and robotics, you're smoking something, and yes, you are inhaling.
Well, I live in Colorado, so there's a lot of that going on.
Well, I live in Texas, and we just legalized some kind of medical kind of marijuana. I don't know. It's not smoking, but oils or something, which here in Texas is like, what?
Right, right. Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was so one of the things that I talked about in that particular podcast on the reputation economy, and something that I'm really becoming a firm believer. I see it already, and I've actually run across a couple technology companies that are doing it. But I still think that there's going to at some point be an employability score where they will look at all of the different abstract things that you've done in your career, and they're going to assign it a value that will eventually be calculated into a score that will say, does this person even meet this minimum threshold in order to apply? And when they do that, I hope that at some point they take into account the soft skills that people need to run a business or to run a management team or to run a project, because those are some of the most important skills, not the ones that you can necessarily, give a mathematical number to.
Well, there was an article I just shared on social media that was one of the major consulting firms in the world is now using facial recognition in they do Skype kind of interviews, recorded interviews where you just, and then they go analyze that with automation, and that's how they select who actually gets to talk to a real human being.
So we talked earlier about how, we get to a certain point in our career, especially us older generation, we'll say, where, we start to question, is this really what we're supposed to do with our life? Is this really what it's all about? Because we didn't know that it was okay to actually go pick a career that it was aligned with our value system, for example. And so for those of us who are a little bit further along in our careers, and we're at that point where we're saying, okay, what's next? Do I really want to do this with the rest of my life? Those folks are probably contemplating some type of career reinvention. When you talk to clients who come to you and they're in that situation, how important is it for them to truly know themselves before they start to choose their next path?
Well, one of the key things that happens to most of us is we go to work and we play a role at work. In other words, you're an actor. You're supposed to behave in a certain way in different jobs. And what happens is we start taking on that role persona. And over time, we may very well decide we are that persona. And I'm going to use myself as a classic example. I'm a closet introvert. I was a very shy kid. By the way, I'm a phenomenally good public speaker. That's what I did for IBM for 10 years. I am really good at working a networking event. I can go into a dinner party and I can work the room with the best. You know what? When I'm done, I'm exhausted. I am not an extrovert, although I appear to be one and I sometimes think I am one. I'm not. The problem is I get paid more to be an extrovert. And at some point you have to make choices. I'll use the example. I've just dropped my National Speakers Association membership. It's only my local chapter because, I have people tell me, you could start doing the association tour. Nope, I can't do that. I can't do that every week. I'll be exhausted. So that's where we get people who say, well, but I'm this way. I said, no, you behave that way. And there's a difference between who you are and the way you behave. This is the person I've become, or the way I've learned to behave. And by the way, it may not be all that healthy for me.
I know many folks just, throughout my career that you run into and you talk with them outside of work, and they truly are a different person because they adapt the way they work to the environment in which they find themselves when they go to work. And it's not necessarily who they are. And I've seen them get worn out, and I've seen them burn out. And, you know, sometimes they just up and leave jobs, and which is sad, because, you know, they're excellent at what they do, but it doesn't align with who they are. So therefore the company, you know, who doesn't recognize that and doesn't get them into that right position is really losing out on a good employee. And I know for me, one of the things that I do when I have clients come to me and they start to express these feelings of, you know, I'm not really sure where I'm at in my life and where am I going and all that, I recommend that they take some assessments to kind of help them get to know themselves, find their strengths, find their, you know, their, what they're good at, what they don't like, what gives them strength, what drains them. And I know you are a advocate of an assessment called the Berkman Profile. Yep. Can you tell me a little bit about what the Berkman Profile is?
Yeah. What I love about the Berkman is it will tell you how you behave, which is what DISC and Myers-Briggs and all those, but will also tell you how you want to be treated in that same area. So it says, by the way, I'm very social. By the way, at the same time, I want to be by myself. Okay, those don't correlate.
Right.
I've got several clients who I refer to as my structured anarchists. In other words, they appear incredibly orderly. By the way, when you look at them, every piece of clothing is exactly in place. If they have hair, and Ryan, I know you can appreciate this,
yeah, yeah,
then every piece of hair is exactly in place. They speak very precisely. They're very, very rule-oriented. The problem is the rules have to be theirs. In other words, they're really good at walking into chaos and bringing order. Now, the problem is, the assumption is, okay, they fixed the machine. Now you're so orderly, we want you to turn the crank. We want you to run things. And by the way, what happens with every last one of them is they get incredibly frustrated.
Yeah.
Because the way they behave, no one would ever know, oh, I want to go into that chaos and fix things. You want to go where? And that's where, you know, the roles you take on, you can very easily then be misperceived and, by the way, misplaced, which is the challenge, because so many of us, we didn't choose what we wanted to do. We chose what we wanted to do by what was in at the time, or we waited for someone to present an opportunity to us and we could either, you would usually take it. And so you end up with these people. Every educator I have done to this date has been what I call my stealth competitors. And that is, they're sweet, lovely people. They're really nice. And by the way, they're almost all women. And this is particularly true of women in society. And this is, you know, if you listen to this Microsoft CEO last couple of years ago at the women's conference where he said, oh, you know, don't ask for a pay raise. It's bad karma. Our society particularly tells women you should never ask for what you want. So they end up doing that, and they end up being these stealth competitors. And by the way, at times it actually works for people. I've seen big gaps in salespeople. Salespeople who behave very direct, but they want lots of respect. They don't want people to be direct back at them. So what way it works for them is when they meet a new client, the first thing they do is they back off and become very good listeners. And then once they've gained the respect, they revert back. And it's very typical of salespeople. Now, by the way, that works really well in sales. By the way, it really sucks in the interview situation. And I have to retrain them for an interview to say, okay, you got to walk in and you can't follow your instincts of being a really good listener. That's what I love about the assessment. And there are a bunch of other things about it. But the challenge with the Berkman is it's real complicated. And a lot of folks don't like it because it is so complicated. But it's the closest thing to measuring emotional intelligence.
So if I took the Berkman, what are some of the things that I would take away from it? Obviously, it gives me, you said, who I am and how I, you know, how you believe. What other things can you expect to get from the Berkman? Like, does it give sections on career suggestions, that type of thing as well?
I don't believe that. Yes, it does the career stuff. I don't believe in any of that, because the problem is careers are changing too fast.
Okay.
Right. What it does do is, so for example, I use it. I, I use it to, number one, poke you to go back to the best of times and the worst of times in your career and get you to understand why, right? And I have methods for doing that. Yes, I know how to poke you in the underbelly. By the way, this works for those of us who have 20 plus years of experience. It doesn't work so well with the kids because they don't have enough life experience. It'll give me a decision-making style. And by the way, I will then say, okay, take that decision-making style and go find three problems you solved in your personal life and three problems you solved at work. How the heck did you do it? And once, because when I use the assessment is kind of to poke you to get you to go back and re-examine, how do you think? Now, I'll use the example. I am at one extreme. I'm a recovering engineer. Yes, there's a 12-step program for that. And I am what the Berkman calls a linear concrete thinker, which is give me the facts, get the hell out of my way, and I put everything into systems. Okay? I work with a lot of product managers who are the polar opposite of me. They're what they call global conceptual thinkers. They like looking at big problems and peeling them back at a layer at a time. They're completely nonlinear. When you ask them at the end, how'd you come to that conclusion? They'll go, isn't it obvious? Because they haven't got a clue. The final decision making was completely intuitive. Those are polar opposites. Those can be very complementary as long as you know your polar opposites. And by the way, once you understand how you think, you will see others and you suddenly go, wow, they think different from me.
Now, and it sounds like so there's a whole section in your book that you refer to as the personal operating system. It sounds like a lot of Berkman's results are feeding into helping you create or at least identify what your own personal operating system is.
Sure. Let me give you one other example. The Berkman stress report will give you your top 40 needs. And then I have you synthesize those down to about 10. And then I have you write an open-ended question for each of those needs and also document what are you listening for.
Explain that.
Sure. I suck with bosses. I'm not good with bosses. So if I said, tell me about your management style. If they immediately said, oh, by the way, we're going to measure you every week, I know to say goodbye. Tell me what my typical day is going to look like. I am what they refer to as very low change, which means don't interrupt me and don't screw with my schedule. And so if you told me I'm going to work in an open office environment and I'm going to be interacting with people all day, I know that's not going to work.
Which is something that some people probably don't even realize about themselves.
Right. It's been very interesting after I got my Berkman results and now I realize that, one of the best things I ever did was get off Outlook, and I'm on Gmail now, and I don't have the Outlook automatic download turned on.
Okay.
I've done this with several low change clients. We turn that off, and their days get so much better because they're not interrupted every 15 minutes.
It's amazing when you become more self-aware how you can use the knowledge about yourself and where you know you work best, even what environment you work best in order to make career decisions.
Well, I'll use the other example is back in the 1980s, I was pulling drafting boards away from mechanical engineers when I worked at IBM. I support about 500 engineers. And I was constantly being interrupted. I now realize the way I coped with that was when someone came in with a problem, I had total control over when that problem got solved. You were a nice person to me. You went to the top of the list. You were a jerk. You went to the bottom of the list. And no one for 7 years questioned that. So that was, suddenly I can go back and say, okay, that was my coping mechanism. That's how I dealt with it. Now, if someone had jerked me around, well, why haven't you fixed Burl's problem yet? I would have probably not dealt with it anywhere nearly as well. And it's, it, and I can, again, I can go back and look at my career and say, wow, that's why that situation worked. And this is why this one didn't.
So for those who haven't yet determined their personal operating system, they don't know what makes them tick, what environments they work well in, and so on. Why should they be cautious when they are presented, let's say, with their dream job?
Well, number one, there is no such thing as a dream job.
Okay.
Right. I'm sorry. I don't believe that. Every job has its pluses and minuses. And by the way, if you think it's your dream job, you are suffering from what I call MSU.
Mm-hmm.
Make stuff up.
Okay.
Right? You can replace stuff with a four letter other word.
Right.
Right. And by the way, we all do.
Sure.
So it's going in with your eyes wide open. And going, okay, what's the facts, and really, really doing your homework. And what happens with most of us when we think we're taking our dream job, it really isn't. Every job has its ups and its downs, but it's becoming aware. And by the way, you will be good at certain things that suck the life out of you. Mm. I use the example of me as a public speaker. I use a term that was coined by Susan Cain in a book called Quiet. It's about introversion. She calls the term she uses is restorative niches.
Okay.
And restorative niches is where you schedule things into your day that restore you. So I have a former client who knows that she's supposed to take a drawing pad out 2 to 3 times a day. It has nothing to do with work. She just feels better if she takes 10 minutes and draws. Now, drives her nuts, her husband nuts, because she has drawings all over the house now. I use example. I'm a big outdoors guy. So my Thursdays, I live in a condo. I live in a treehouse here in Austin. And so I either take all my calls sitting by a window on one of my outside balconies, or Thursday afternoons, I do back-to-back calls. I take them actually on a bridge out in a hollow outside my condo. I feel better.
I would too if I got to do that, right? With my calls.
I had one client who had to speak at a conference like 6 times in 2 days. And I told him between each session, he has to go back to his hotel room, get out one of his novels, and for 45 minutes sit and read.
Hmm.
And it recharged him. And it's kind of, and it's to schedule those into your day, schedule those particularly at times when you're doing something that's going to suck the life out of you. And we all know those times because we walk away and we go thunk.
Right. Right. Yeah. I know for me, especially the restorative niches, I hadn't heard the term until I read your book, but like I've learned about myself and actually assessments I've taken, I've not taken the Berkman yet, but different ones I've taken, they've all told me that in order for me to be at my best, I actually have to schedule alone time for myself.
Yes.
Throughout the course of the day. Otherwise, all of the stuff that I'm working on can very quickly overwhelm me, and it will just crush me. And so I have to schedule alone time for myself so that I can sit back and, you know, basically take all these different bowling balls, if you will, and align them in an order that makes sense to me so that I can then go and, if you will, attack the rest of the day. And I've noticed a huge change in me and my productivity when I'm able to get that alone time during the course of a workday.
Yeah, it's interesting. I worked with a top flight salesperson, sales lady from a major technology company. And she was a closet introvert, big time. But her husband was a big time extrovert. And so they were together. They worked together at the same company. And they were at a conference, and at the end of the day, he's going, let's go out and party. And she's going, I'm going to get room service and going back to the room. So he tells everyone else she's not feeling well. She's sick. And she's not. She just says, I'm toast. I'm done. And the difference is he gets energy from that. And she has the life sucked out of her.
As we're talking about kind of the, you know, making stuff up and how it impacts your career and all these different things, you introduce what I'm going to call a new word here that I find very fascinating. I still like it. I like to say it. But tell me a little bit about awfulizing, and how does that impact us?
Oh, sure. Well, we make stuff up. So I'll use the example. I recently had a client. She's a director at a major pharmaceutical company, and she needs to get out. And so suddenly she applied for this job at this next pharma company, and she's not getting any response. And she's just going, what the hell's going on there? Why don't they call me? And she just throws herself into a fit. And I said, you have a contact with the company, right? Yeah. Well, why don't you call her? So she finally, okay. Calls up her contact. Contact walks into the hiring manager's office and says, why haven't you called my friend? And he goes, I never saw her resume.
No.
They have a crappy applicant tracking system.
I think a lot of companies do.
Right? She made all this stuff up. I have another client who's 65, and she's really bad at making stuff up. And she's been really, it's been a very difficult last 6 months where she's been up. She's in the running for a position at a major nonprofit, and she hasn't heard back, and she hasn't heard back. And she's making stuff up in her brain and just going, and on the plane back, she was visiting her grandkids. She read my MSU chapter, and she's going, okay, I got to stop making stuff up. She gets off the plane. While she's riding the tram back to the long-term parking, she gets an email that says, oh, by the way, can you come in Tuesday for an interview? Because she just didn't know, and she filled the void. And of course, she filled the void with everything. It was awful.
Right. Yeah. And your analogy to help get over that for folks is the old stop, drop, and roll.
Because
it's not just for fires anymore.
That's right. It's coming up with a stop, drop, and roll procedure to saying, okay, I've done this. And in the book, I talk about the stop, drop, and roll. I have a client who works for a bully. And every time her boss would call her, she'd panic. So what she's learned how to do is don't answer the phone. And she was at a conference. The boss called her. She was in a session. She didn't answer it. She texted her back. Is there something I can help you with? And the boss responded back saying, oh, I just wanted to tell you that I'm coming up to the conference too. But her brain immediately went, oh, I'm going to go get beat up because she's calling me. And when we have learned to do things like when she walks into a meeting with her boss, she waits for her boss to sit down and then she sits on the same side of the table so that her boss can't easily look at her and then pick on her.
That seems unhealthy.
Oh, it's very unhealthy. It's incredibly unhealthy. There's a book I love called Necessary Endings by Dr. Henry Cloud.
I've heard of it.
Right, it's a great book. But one of the chapters is you deal with three kinds of people: wise people, stupid people, and evil people. Wise people you can reason with. Stupid people are the ones who go, well, you didn't meet your target. And the person goes, well, someone else didn't meet their target, so I didn't meet mine. And you can't reason with people like that. And then we have my client's boss, who's just flat evil. And so the point there is you learn to figure out how to buffer yourself. Dr. Cloud talks about that's when you go get lawyers. right? You get someone just in between because they're evil. And we probably have all worked with some of those people at some time.
No, I don't think so.
and be able to say, okay, if I'm dealing with these kind of people, you know, if I'm dealing with a stupid person, quit reasoning with them because it doesn't work. If you're dealing with an evil person, okay, how am I going to buffer myself from this person and figure out strategies?
And speaking of strategies, actually, it's a good pivot point here, because a good chunk of your book is based on a lot of what we talked about now, which is really getting to know yourself and understanding how you behave, how you act, what energizes you, what doesn't energize you, what environments you should work in versus shouldn't, and really getting to know yourself to the point where you can make smarter decisions. decisions about where, you know, which position to take next and where to take your career, whether it's a pivot or a reinvention altogether. And one of the things that you talk a lot about towards the end of the book is strategic networking. And so the question that came to my mind was before I read the chapter was, well, what's the difference between strategic networking and networking? So how are they different?
Okay. It's in today's world, I can figure out exactly who I need to meet. All right. I can get on LinkedIn and I can find people on LinkedIn who are in strategic positions. I very often look at, particularly when you're making a fairly significant pivot, is looking for people, as I like to say, who look, taste, and smell like you. So I have a client up in Virginia, late 50s. She has turned herself into a Ruby on Rails programmer in her late 50s. And so one of the things I had her do was get on LinkedIn and look for everybody in her area that had Ruby on Rails in their profile. Then you look at, okay, 95% of them are young guys, and you'll start looking at the pictures for people who look older. Okay, what did she find? All those older-looking people all worked for government agencies. Now, she just got a job offer with a contract company for the Defense Department. Fair hiring. Now, they don't pay as much, but in her case, she needs the foot in the door, right? So you start looking at, I can easily figure out if I want to go work for, you know, a company XYZ, and then start looking at, okay, who works there? Who's doing the kind of work I want to go do? And then you connect with them. Hopefully you can schedule a quick phone call and say, do you like working there?
That's the next question. How do you vet out a company? I mean, so you use the strategic networking to find people at places you want to work and within your profession. But how do you determine that a company that you say you want to work for, is it actually a company that aligns with your values and in a place that you'd actually want to work?
Well, you ask people who are working there. By the way, those are the same people who can pull you in once they get to know you. And then the second is ask people who've left. And then say, why'd you leave? And you'll get a more authentic answer.
Yeah. Once there's nothing tied to the job, right?
Right. You know, we have a very famous public company here in Austin that it was a startup. And it was a sexy startup and it went public. And I had a client who wanted to interview there. And we reached out to three people who had left and said, why'd you leave? And all responded back, toxic work environment.
Ooh.
And I'm a sponsor of a unconference here called Product Camp Austin. And I was doing one of my talks and I mentioned and I alluded to the company name. And a guy in the back said, yeah, the company sucks. The only reason I stay there is they keep on throwing stock options at me. But if you look in the paper and look in the business journal, it's a great place to work. No, it's not.
You close the book out by discussing something. The chapter is called How to Answer the Dreaded Question. And so my mind immediately went to the place where I bet the majority of listeners' minds are right now, which is, oh, you're talking about the tell me yourself question. However, that is not the dreaded question that you talk about in the book. The dreaded question that you are referring to is the one that you get, that all of us get asked, but I don't think that we understand what makes it dreaded. And that question is, why do you want to leave your current position? Why is that question so relevant to, especially to answer correctly?
Well, if you are running away from a job, you may be leaving a toxic environment. I'll use an example. I just talked with a prospective client this morning who's going, they're trying to get rid of me. And it's like, if you walk in saying, yeah, they're going to get ready to fire me, you can't say that. But more importantly, I'll use the example. I left my last corporate gig, and hopefully I will never have to work at in a corporate environment ever again. My boss put me in an unethical position. He asked me to hire a relative of a senior executive who was unqualified. And we were a public company at that point. And I went, no. And he was the closest thing I've ever had to a sociopath. So I can't say that if I would interview. But what I can say is, I had a, it was a great run while it lasted, but what I'm really looking for is XYZ. So it's answering the question positively, deflecting it, but responding back with a question on where you want to go, not while you're leaving.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I think in one of the examples I gave was, I love my last job. I was teaching at a university. I got lots of good strokes for my students. But what I'm really looking is getting back into the PR world. And I really want, I want to get back to the interaction with adults. And is Sen saying, here's what I'm looking for. She wanted out of the university setting. The problem was she got lots of strokes from her students and nothing from her superiors. In her case, it was real important that she got strokes from her superiors, which, by the way, you'll never get at a university. And so you kind of say, you know, I got lots of good strokes. I enjoyed it. I love my job. I love teaching the students. But what I want to go is back into the PR industry where I get lots of interaction with customers. And the idea is to pivot it back with a question so they don't dig.
Got it. Yeah. And turning it back to a question puts them on defense, if you will, because they weren't expecting it. So now they have to answer that question and they may even totally forget the fact that they're trying to figure out why you want to leave your current job.
Yeah. The one thing, particularly if you are leaving a toxic environment, is you don't want to get them to dig. Now, by the way, this is same true in networking. When I left my last job and I had people dig on why I had left, if I let them get to that point, by the way, when I was done, I felt really miserable, right? It was a bad situation. I don't want to go back there, so I don't let them go back there. And we've all left toxic environments at some point in time. And you go, okay, just let's leave it alone.
Yeah, that's an easy scab to pick.
Yes. Yes, and we don't want to have people pick at those scabs, because if you actually say what you think,
I've been in those interviews before. Yeah. not with me, but listening to someone actually say what they thought. I actually had a guy one time during an interview tell me the reason he left his last job was because he got in a fist fight with his boss.
Ooh.
And he was supposed to report to me. So how quickly do you think I showed him the door?
Yes. Yeah, you these are places you just can't go. So you find ways. If they ask, you learn to deflect, and the idea is to pivot back with a question to where you want to go.
Yeah, very good advice. Keep the interview focused on the positive stuff. Why you want to be there? How you help them? And stick away from the scab.
Yes,
stay away from the scab. All right, I want to close this out today, Mark. Tell me about your podcast, the Reinvent Your Career podcast.
Well, it's the Repurpose Your Career pod.
Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. I read the wrong sentence. Repurpose Your Career podcast.
Yes, we launched it in October of last year, where today I think I'm publishing episode 35. I do it in a four-part sequence. I do first is interviewing with an expert. Then I interview someone who has actually made a late career pivot, and I've had 8 so far, and the common theme among all of them has been they had the idea they needed to make a change, and they didn't do anything. Then second, there was a kick in the ass moment that said, you need to go do this. And the third is it didn't turn out the way they expected. That's the key piece, is you can't have a belief that things are going to come as exactly as they expected. And the third in the series is me choosing what I want to do. Lately, I'm going to be reading chapters from my book, because I actually produced the audio version of the book. And the fourth one is I answer listeners' questions.
Awesome. I've listened to it before. It's very good. You do a great job, especially with the interviews, pulling information about how people feel through the process of, you know, pivoting in their careers. When does it release so people can go sign up and subscribe?
Every Monday, usually midday Monday, it releases. And it's been an interesting experience. I am a much better interviewee than an interviewer.
I don't know if I would say that. I think you do a pretty good job.
You can respect this. they are highly edited. But I'm asking questions because I find I get, you know, cotton mouth and
it's easy to do. Podcasting is a lot harder than what I think a lot of people believe it to be.
Well, I'm a polished. I've been doing interviews and I've been doing webinars. I did my first webinar in 1997. You know, I started speaking for a living in the mid 80s. So if I'm doing my spiel, I'm very smooth. If I suddenly have to kind of stream up stuff on the fly, I'm not quite so good.
I've had those moments too. I think every podcaster has.
Yes.
All right, Mark, what are some of the best ways for people to get in touch with you?
Sure. They can reach out to me at careerpivot.com. You can hit the contact me link at the top or the bottom of the page. There's a speaker pipe on the right side. You can email me at Mark, it's M-A-R-C, my mama knew how to spell, at careerpivot.com. If you go to careerpivot.com/podcast, you will find my podcast. If you'll hit the little subscribe button on any of the pages, you will get my Career Insights email, which comes out every Sunday. And I'm Career Pivot at Career Pivot on Twitter. You can find me as Mr. Miller, M.R. Miller, on LinkedIn. Yes, my mama gave me those initials, so I get some respect. And of course, there is the Career Pivot Facebook page, which you need to go out and like because it's lonely.
Would you have any final thoughts or words of wisdom, tips you'd like to pass on to anybody that's listening today?
Sure. The thing is, learning to look at yourself, making sure you really know who you are. By the way, the key piece is get out of your own head. Now, this might be hiring a coach like myself. It may be working with a spouse, a friend. By the way, some of my best brand stories have been written by adult daughters. Is getting out of your own head. That is absolutely key because we tend to think about stuff all
the time. That is true. I know personally I do. That's why I need to schedule my alone time. All right, Mark, as always, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I highly recommend anybody listening, head out, pick up a copy of your book. And thank you for taking time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Look for my interview of Ryan in the next episode. Please pick up a copy of Repurpose Your Career, a practical guide for the second half of life at Amazon.com or any of the other fine online retailers. When you complete reading the book, I would very much appreciate if you would write an honest review on Amazon.com. As I stated earlier in the podcast, I have started recording the audio version of the book. Lastly, I am working on the Career Pivot Community website. This will be a membership area of the current careerpivot.com website, and I have an initial cohort of members helping me develop the content. Look for more on this in the coming months. Thank you for listening all the way to the end of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. You will find all the show notes at careerpivot.com/episode-42. Please hop over to careerpivot.com and subscribe to get updates on this podcast and all the other happenings at Career Pivot. I publish a blog post with show notes every Tuesday morning. If you subscribe to the Career Pivot blog, you will receive the Career Pivot Insights email every Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Hope to see you next Monday for another episode of the Repurpose Your Career podcast.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh! There it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.